This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
In 1984, I was hospitalized for approaching perfection. Slowly screwing my way across Europe, they had to make a correction.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your Snow is Falling in Manhattan of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
I tell you they make it so you can't shake hands when they make your hand shake. I know you like to line dance. Everything's so democratic.
This week on Popcast, we are going to celebrate David Berman. David Berman of Silver Jews and Purple Mountains. Berman took his own life earlier this month. There's just been a tremendous outpouring in the wake of his death from his fans. At the beginning of the episode, what we were listening to is Random Rules, and that's from the third Silver Jews album, American Water. Berman was kind of an uncharacteristically intimate and raw and direct songwriter. He's been putting out records since the mid-90s, and also, especially from the mid-2000s forward, kind of had this publicly troubled character or role. He was very front and center with the things that he was struggling with. And so what I wanted to do is really try to understand Berman from a few different perspectives on this episode of Popcast. So we're going to have three conversations this week. First, we're going to talk to Nick Weidenfeld. Nick, in 2005, wrote the first kind of real David Berman profile and got to spend a lot of time with him and really learned a lot about him that then, via that article, really helped to shape the narrative of who Berman was and what he was struggling with also. Then we're going to talk to Amanda Petrusich from The New Yorker, and we're going to talk about Berman's music and his songwriting and how he compared to the other bands and artists and songwriters of his eras. And then Jeff Johnson's going to call in. Jeff is an old music writer and editor who became friends with Berman over the years and was going to give us a little bit of a sense of who Berman was when public eyes were not gazing on him and public ears were not listening to him. I think in order to really understand the arc of David Berman, the art of David Berman, we want to go back and talk about kind of Berman's 1.0 creative period, the 90s into the early 2000s. One thing about that time is David Berman did not really do very much press. He was notoriously unwilling, reluctant to sit down and be interviewed. But then in 2005, this very, very big interview came out in The Fader, and it was by Nick Weidenfeld, and it was the first time that Berman had ever really spoken at length, and judging by the story, spoken at lengthy length. And Nick is calling in from L.A. now. Hey, man, what's going on?
Hey, you know, still a bit sad about all this.
Yeah, of course.
For sure.
So Nick, for those who don't know, Nick was a music journalist in the 2000s and has worked in television for a long time as a TV producer now. But this is one of the stories that I always remember of yours from that time period. And I was glad to see actually The Fader reposted it online. It had sort of been lost in the internet wilds. So I'm glad that it's actually back up now. So tell us a little bit about when you first encountered Berman's work and kind of what spoke to you about it. Presumably, I would guess, in the 90s, long before you actually got to talk to him.
Yeah, I mean, definitely long before. I was not an indie rock guy at all.
I can relate, absolutely.
To be honest, like, almost my basic entire childhood through, like, any coming of age, all the way, you know, up to now, but truly through college, like, or entering college, was like exclusively hip hop.
Right.
It was like Wu-Tang to the Far Side, but that was it. You know, mm-hmm. I really didn't give a lot of attention to when my friends all got into Pearl Jam and grunge. You know, I grew up in DC, so I went to Fugazi shows, but like I didn't pay much attention to it. It was just not for me. And I very specifically remember being in college, and so it's 98, and in the first few weeks, I feel some kid on my floor walking into my dorm, and I had gotten to know him a bit, and like giving me the American Water CD.
And that's the third Silver Jews album.
That's the third Silver Jews, so it's 98. Mm-hmm. It's like right, it had just come out, and playing it, you know, for me, and that really being the first like non-rap album that I listened to and became like really, really, really obsessed by, and then sort of worked my way backwards fairly quickly. Berman got very obsessed, as like so many people, and as you can sort of really see after his death, like so many people just became so like, you know, truly obsessed by the work. And I think that what spoke to me about it was a little bit just like hip hop. I mean, it was,
yeah, it's rappy. We were just talking about this before we started taping, but like for someone especially whose framework was rap music, you know, obviously I would never say Berman was rapping, but he is talking as much as he's singing. He is playing with rhyme scheme. He is narrative. Like for someone who had been acclimated to music through the lens of rapping,
yeah,
Berman is actually a pretty logical entree into this world, more so than a lot of other bands of the day.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's taken me sort of a while to sort of understand why that's the case. And then from there, you know, it sort of grew out into like, oh, now I'm like revisiting like Pavement and all and Sonic Youth and sort of growing out. And that through him, which I think is really unusual because he really fully considered himself, I think, an outlier of so much of this. Like yeah. He was sort of his own island, you know, I think both emotionally and professionally, musically. I think he thought of himself as an island, but I did. It was sort of my like entree into all of the stuff. It is lyric forward. It is mm-hmm. very clever. It is very, very funny. It is very, very sad. American Water specifically has like a ton of like, because he's doing it with his friends at that time, you
right.
know, like he's doing it with Malcolmus, he's doing it with Nostandrous, you know, the Pavement guys.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's specifically in that album first, there is an exuberance and like a joy.
Is there a particular song that sticks in your head from that album?
For me, and it, you know, it's very hard. Everyone will tell you sort of just go through the whole thing like very clearly. I think if you were thinking about the exuberance of it all, Send in the Clouds.
That's funny. That's the one I was going to say.
You know, I don't think that's like a sleeper hit for any. And that's what's so amazing about it. So he had such a small catalog of work. I think that's the other reason people could get so obsessed by it is because you can really, if you want to devour it,
you can get your arms around it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I can't, even if you were like, I love Little Peep right now, it's like, I don't think you could listen to all of Little Peep's music. And he was around for such a short period of time.
Right.
You know, just the way in which people put music out, I just think that he was so particular about it. It does allow you to like, yeah, wrap your arms around it, as you said, and really make it your own.
All right, so let's listen to Send in the Clouds. Let's listen to a little bit of this.
Why can't monsters get along with other monsters? Swat a song shrug. Swat a song shrug. Yeah. Swat a song shrug. We'll be right back.
the whole album, while it is, has all of the darkness and really self-deprecation that I think all of the records, you know, that is sort of how he is defined. There really is a, like, you know, a joy and like, and not an ironic joy, not just playing sort of positive, like sort of upbeat major key music against sort of sad lyrics, you know, like there really is like some joy. And I think one of the reasons is because this is really sort of the last time he's going to play with that group of friends. And I visit him later, and it's very hard for me to go back and revisit a lot of the stuff because of the time that I spent with him and what I sort of learned about him. And if you think of this arc of all of his music and these albums as a real, like, personal growth and arc for him, you know, he's always struggled with drugs and alcohol. And this is, especially in the time I spent with him, this seems like it's the time where it's like, it's Friday night, it's 2 a.m., the drugs are still really fun.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's about 6 a.m. is going to come in the form of, you know, Bright Flight a couple of years later. And it's going to be in a really dark period. But this is when things are still really raucous and fun.
But it's also tough to, like you say, it's tough to know what's behind that.
Well, I mean, yeah, at the time, I don't know any of this. And then when we were spending time together, and it's a story I, you know, he told me on the record, it just didn't make it into the article for many reasons. But, you know, he's talking through, like, his life at this period. And, you know, he tells me, like, when he's about to do Send in the Clouds, which I think of as just this, like, absolute, like, moment of just, like, fun and silliness. As he's Send in the Clouds, he comes in, he's like, oh, yeah, I just had this giant line of Coke. And
yeah.
I was like, I'm going to do that right into the Send in the Clouds. That's going to be how when he told me that on one occasion, that might be what a, like an interesting, fun story.
Right.
And on the occasion of him saying, I had just, you know, I'm telling you, I am a really terrible drug addict that has just committed suicide. And you go, wow, that makes me reflect on that whole album and that experience in like a very different way. It's hard for me to even hear that line again going, oh, wow, this is like, yeah, very different. It's a very different scene than I thought was happening with these sort of like academic, probably a little too cocky, but sort of fun-loving guys. It was like, it's a very different scene. It's very hard to divorce that from the music now.
Right, and I think, not that people romanticize things like that, but I do think that, I think there are a lot of people that kind of wanted to protect Berman a little bit, that sort of felt like their fandom was like, maybe they could swaddle him in some way.
Yeah.
You spent time with him in 2005, and that is a couple years after basically a suicide attempt, and I think the article was titled Dying in the Al Gore Suite, or something along those lines, and that is basically a reference to, I mean, you describe that day, basically, which I presume he described to you. So tell us a little bit about what was going on with David Berman in 2003. That, for those who haven't read the article, catch them up. You talked to him on his fifth album, and that was his first extended interview, which is crazy when you think about it in, like, the ubiquitous press cycle universe we live in now.
It's insane.
Yeah.
You know, the Silver Jews are basically formed in 1989. They come out with a couple small things, so it's not crazy they would have had no press. But then Pavement gets really famous.
Right. And Pavement, just for clarity, Pavement, they all went to University of Virginia. They're all kind of homies from there. Malkmus and Stanovich.
They met at University of Virginia, then moved in together in Jersey. And yeah, they were all part of sort of a similar scene, academic art scene. He goes and does an MFA program because he's a poet.
Right.
During this time that he's making music with these buddies, those buddies have their own band, and that band becomes pretty famous.
Right. That band, Pavement, for those who don't know.
That band being Pavement and Steve Malkmus specifically. So when you just really think about it, they form that band. Then in 1994, they have that album come out with other members that are pretty famous. Then another album in 1996, which is The Natural Bridge. Then American Water, which is the one that turned me on in 1998. Then another album, Bright Flame. And he has done, so now we're getting into 2005 when he's going to do the album I'm interviewing him, and he's literally never done an interview.
So much respect for them.
And he's only done, as far as I was able to find, I think he's only done one or two live performances ever. One was, I think, at like a Drag City showcase,
mm-hmm.
like a song or two. So he's never performed live. He's had five albums. Like, that is, in the way we think about things, like, that is pretty unheard of. Like, I can't even think of anyone having that level of fame and never, you know, I know people, then they like remove themselves from the spotlight after, but, you know, I can't really think of anyone who's sort of never engaged in it at all. And so I'm like a huge, huge fan.
Yeah. I mean, I'm curious to know how it all came to pass that you got to do this.
So like, I'm a huge fan and I was a music journalist, but then I got this job that took me out of being a music journalist, and I went to go work for Adult Swim,
right,
where I was the head of development. And so I kind of like packed up.
You left the game behind.
I left the game. I was like, I'm out. Print media, maybe the future, but I'm out.
Okay. And, well, let me assure you, let me tell you from the inside of the house, like, it's not, but anyway.
So I basically stopped writing, but I know during that period I had like made like a couple like overtures to like want to interview him, and was like at Drag City and was like constantly rebuffed. Like, it's just not an option. You know, he's not interviewing. And then I got a call from, I believe it was my friend who and partner on a lot of stuff, Michael Schmeling, who's a photographer, who is shooting a lot for The Fader.
Right. Shout out Michael Schmeling.
Shout out Michael Schmeling. And he was doing a lot of work for The Fader at that time. And I believe, you know, Will Welch, and this is just sort of a group of people that, you know, are still maybe in the game, but like a group of people I knew were around. And they put in the request, but basically he said, after all these years, I'll do the interview.
Great.
Mm-hmm. And so I got the call saying he'll do the interview. So I came out of retirement.
Right.
And I was like, this is really important to me. So Michael and I drove down there to Nashville, where he was living, which I remember even at the time, that's unusual. I didn't think he lived in Nashville. I would have thought maybe, oh, we're going to go almost anywhere else, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, like, music sort of country. And I know Will Oldham like still lives in Louisville. You know, there's just like, he's already sort of defying certain expectations of mine. But we drove down and he picks us up. And I was just talking with Michael about this. We were at the hotel and he picked us up, and he just like didn't look the way I thought he was going to look. I mean, mm-hmm. he really looked like worn out, and he was really truly lovely and giving. I mean, the idea that, you know, he was like, I'll pick you guys up.
Yep.
I, you know, we were just joking. I remember the whole time he was saying he just needed to pick up a razor from Target, and he just never ended up doing that. And I don't know why that's something that we remember, but it was very personal. Like, it was unusually personal, you know, and it was unusually like intimate.
Well, what I have found, you know, in my career is the people who don't do press aren't in fact the least giving. In many ways, they're the most, because part of the reason that they don't like to engage with press is because they don't know how to be something other than who they are, and they, you know, they want to protect that. So it's hard for him to put on airs. So I'm sure, even though you guys were down there to interview him and engage with him on a media level, I'm sure he didn't have it in him to kind of be like, well, I'm going to give you the press version of David Byrne. You know, like, it just doesn't, it seems unlikely that he was cooked like that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny you say, cause it's, well, I was thinking, oh, I don't know what we do. We go like race go-karts or do whatever.
Whatever you do in a music, right.
What you do in a music interview. But I know the response to that article was so intense,
yeah,
because everyone reading it that was a fan was exactly like me. And we all, for whatever reason, just assumed, not that he was okay, but that he was doing like really well.
Mm.
You know, that, okay, here's a poet. He's a recluse. He's, you know, whatever. We have literary, whether it's Salinger or whoever, we have precedent for like people just not wanting to really talk to the press, whatever. But his music does seem dark, but it also seems like it has sort of like a confidence and a clarity that, here's an academic, right?
Right.
Maybe he's teaching and, you know, he's teaching at Vanderbilt or something. I don't know. Like, everyone assumed he was not just doing well, but that there's a confidence in it.
Right. But you kick it right off the top. I mean, the first sentence in your piece is David Berman died November 19th, 2003.
Right, because after he picked us up, I don't know how long it was. I can't remember, but it has to be within the first hour or so of just like hanging out and driving around Nashville and making more or less small talk, I think, and him showing us places. Maybe we went shopping for something, you know, like he basically just was like, I'm going to tell you this, guys. Like, I tried to kill myself.
Yeah, and you relate the story in, frankly, rather, I don't want to say excruciating detail, but certainly tremendously vivid detail that obviously he had hung on to all those details.
Oh, yeah.
You spent 3 days with him for this piece. You said you, in seeing him, that he was run down. What else did you see in him? And how did that impact how you felt from coming in cold, basically? How did it change you?
In those 3 days, like, we did so much stuff together. Like, we went to dinner with his mom, and I got to know his mom pretty well, and just how funny and interesting she was, and spent time with Cassie, who was, they were separated at the end, but his wife, and, you know, I just, it was, like I said, pretty intimate. And I think that the person that I saw was someone who was, like, genuinely tortured, mm-hmm. right? They were as smart and funny and interesting and insightful as anyone else, but also really wouldn't listened and cared, but also just couldn't stop talking. Now, I think part of that was I was the first person he ever talked to. And I think he had a lot that he just wanted to say. But I said it in the article about and quoting him, and I feel that he said it again in all of the work that was done around his last album, which he put under the name Purple Mountains, not the Silver right. Jews, that he was like, he wasn't doing this really even for him. He was really trying to be a better person for everyone around him because yeah. he put everybody's life through hell. And that so much of the work he did was like trying desperately to be empathetic and to understand and to do right by everyone around him, because he had all these people, like you said, that were really taking care of him. And so I had heard all this music and engaged with it so closely. It made me laugh. It made me feel, you know, like when I needed to, it made me feel like when I'm really like depressed, or, you know, it made me feel all those things that like help you. But at the same time, I felt there was like a very big distance from the artist that was making it. And I didn't really put all of those actual feelings and lines that are in those songs and the obsession with death and the obsession with trying to find and then loss of spirituality, I didn't really put that on him.
As a human.
As a human being. And when it's that compulsive and it's like that pervasive in all the lyrics, it's literally like Lil Peep in every song being like, I'm really, really depressed and I really do a lot of drugs. So when I was there, I was like, oh, this is all very real and yeah. very personal to him. And as clever as it may ever be, it is exactly how he's feeling. And, you know, especially in that last record, it was really difficult for me because, like, I didn't know what to do. You know, in the Purple Mountains, which is essentially when you go back, I don't even think when you go back, it's mm-hmm. a suicide note.
Yeah.
You know, and only one article, I think The Guardian was the only article in reviewing the Purple Mountains record that was like, basically, I hope he's okay.
Yeah.
And so when you say, what is it, did it do to me? I think it was one of, to be able to spend that time with him and to see that has made it me very, very aware of, like, whatever the like performative act is and of an artist or the writing, and then also like taking people at face value of what they're saying. And that this is, you know, you get this beautiful art, but this guy really is in a tremendous spiritual
pain
struggle.
Yeah. I will say this. I do think, because I read that story when it came out and I remember feeling very strongly about it at the time. And I obviously reread it in recent days. And I think it's good that you didn't go in hardened or a skeptic, you know, like I think if you had gone in with skepticism, or not skepticism of him, but just like a little like eye roll, like another tortured artist, whatever, whatever, you wouldn't have been alive to seeing exactly what was happening in that moment. I think you kind of needed the fall from grace a little bit in order to really see it. You need to experience that.
Yeah.
To touch it. And that comes through, at least that comes through for me when I read it again now.
Well, I mean, it was very, very true for me because it wasn't even a mask off situation, right? Like, it was really like, oh, I've been projecting all of these things I think about you, and those aren't real.
Right. It was like your sunglasses came off. His mask didn't come off. Your sunglasses.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And I think that that's really unusual, right? Because, like, most of the time now you'd be like, oh, your social media isn't really who you are.
Right, right, right.
I'm so happy about that. That you said that about that story, and I do think it meant a lot to people. And I do think at the time it also was like he needed to tell that, right?
Yeah.
Like I didn't ask. I didn't ask. He like it just opened up and it all came out. You know, but I will say that in every like really in every obit that's been written, there's some reference to that story, right? And there's some whether it's direct or they just talk about the Al Gore suite and the suicide, and I have felt this I don't know. It's not regret, but there's something about how his whole public narrative, for someone that hated, like, didn't do interviews and had no public persona and, like, really avoided tours and everything else, this one time he did it is, like, that his entire public narrative was sort of defined by his suicide. I've had a lot of, like, weird feelings as a journalist about it.
I guess what I would say is... he told you for a reason, right? This is a person who words were his métier. He told, this is what he did. He was a storyteller. And he knew that you were there and he knew that you were running tape. And he felt either that he had to or that he wanted to share that and share it in that medium. I mean, sometimes when I'm interviewing someone who has a difficult story to tell, sometimes I don't even think of it as like an act of journalism, you know? It's like I'm just like there to transcribe, you know? I'm the vessel. Like you have to get this thing out in the world and I'm the pathway by which you've chosen or have arrived at doing it.
For someone that was so particular about those moments, that when that was the moment that was shared and it was the first moment, it really did become, and I can see now, the major defining point of his narrative. This last album is his way of like talking about it in its, you know, we can briefly go back into the music about doing it like as with the utmost clarity, like specifically, this is how I feel, you know, not a ton of metaphor. This is what it's like to really stare into the void and to really, you know, as he said, the end of all wanting is all that I'm wanting. The album that I was interviewing him for that was coming out was this Tanglewood Numbers, which went back to something like certainly more rock oriented. There's a bigger and there's like more music and it was a fully different sound in a lot of ways than to Bright Flight, which is, I think the darkest, like it's maybe my favorite album. But when I know now what I know, it's like, that's the nadir of his
right.
emotional and spiritual self and the addictions, you know, it's peak drugs and it's really dark. The idea that he can still make that kind of music and write that way, and that is just so outstanding. But so this thing with Tanglewood Numbers, he's like, he just did not want it. I just remember him over and over again, I just do not want this to be like a sober record. Like he's just like every artist gets like sober and they make some positive, you know, sort of banal. It's just like their worst record. Like, I do not want this to be a recovery record. It's the worst. And you can, all those artists feel so good about themselves and they just make, and he kept saying that. And I think that when you go back and you're like, it's definitely not.
What do you think is a good emblematic song off this record?
The number one is opening.
Yeah.
Because it's Punks in the Beer Light. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's one of the, like, truly one of his greatest songs.
Let's listen to Punks in the Beer Light.
Where's the paper bag that holds the liquor? Just in case I feel the need to puke. If we'd know. Chosen to
something about how he looked at the true darkness and pain and loneliness of everything without emotion. Mm-hmm. And that he was so able to just suss it all out, right? And then deliver lines that are both, so it doesn't feel ironic and it doesn't feel like it's undercutting it, or it doesn't feel like it's trying to take some of the sting away. It doesn't romanticize. It's like truly like, I've seen it and this is how bad it is and it's awful. And now I've seen it with such clarity, I can then write a line that's either super funny about it or super sad or whatever. It's like, there's just, I don't know any other artist that was able to like really see the darkness like with such profound clarity in such a real way. And so if I were to play one song from Purple Mountains,
okay,
I'd play that. That's just the way that I feel.
I'm sure that we could spend many, many more hours detailing all of the Berman time that you spent together and the key things about his work. But I think we're going to stop there for now. And Nick, I really appreciate you doing some of this processing work with me here on Popcast today.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. It's sort of cathartic to talk about it.
Let's take in the clarity, I would say the acuity of the pain on That's Just the Way That I Feel. We're back with segment two of our celebration of the life of David Berman. Amanda Petrus is just here.
Hey. Thank you for having me.
Amanda's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and Amanda wrote about the work of Berman in the wake of his death. And there are a number of very good short phrases in your piece, but the one that I kept coming back to was hilarious and dire. Hilarious and dire. And as someone who was not incredibly familiar with Berman's earlier work and has really been kind of absorbing a lot recently, that really spoke super loudly to me. Let's talk a little generally before we dive into some of the specifics. What about Berman's songwriting? How did he achieve this? Because this is an achievement.
Right.
It's not offhand.
Yeah.
It's an achievement.
Right. I think quite deliberate, quite intentional, the sort of pairing of those two things, the kind of humor, sort of way of laughing at the almost preposterous darkness of his life, the darkness of any life. Yeah, it was extraordinary. I think it was kind of his singular gift as a lyricist. Mm-hmm. And you and I were talking a little bit earlier about the kind of strange challenge when someone dies of sort of distilling their entire kind of gestalt, you know what I mean? Yeah. Their discography, who they were, into, you know, a few phrases or a few sentences. And those were the two words that kind of kept coming back to me in terms of what he could offer an audience that felt really unique and really powerful and really comforting, right? Because pain is sort of funny. I mean, pain is boring and it's funny and it's absurd. And I think Berman was a guy who really got that instinctively.
Yeah. And I think Berman's capacity to kind of stare into some terrible abyss, his own terrible abyss, and kind of come out with something that was kind of like remarkably crisp.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. I developed this recipe when I was down in Georgia with my family. It stars a Korean red pepper powder called gochugaru. I love the way it blooms in the maple syrup and the rice vinegar. If you don't have gochugaru, you should totally get some. It's super versatile. It's not just that it brings heat, but fruity sweetness as well. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
Like, just like that anyone, even someone not in an abyss, could sort of be like, oh, okay, yeah, that's transporting. It captures everything. Right. It's immediate. He's a very wordy writer, but there is something very immediate about how he telegraphed feeling.
Yeah, and it was so precise. I mean, even what you're saying, that word abyss, which I think is the right word to describe what I think Berman would refer to as his treatment-resistant depression. Mm-hmm. Abyss is the right word for that. But an abyss is, you know, you're blind in an abyss, but somehow this dude wasn't. Yeah. You know, he saw it so clearly and could articulate it so eloquently and so beautifully. And again, so, you know, with such humor that it's incredible. I think that was the thing that people found in his music that they couldn't find anywhere else.
Were you sort of into Berman from the beginning? Were you kind of into the Silver Jews kind of from the mid-90s forward, or did you arrive later?
Yeah, I was there. You know, I was a big Pavement fan. Sure. And I am sort of ashamed to say this because I feel like later on in my Jews fandom, I became very kind of defensive of them getting called a Pavement side project.
That's okay.
You know, there was probably some self-loathing baked into that. But I did sort of come to them sideways. You know, I was a Pavement fan first and then sort of worked my way backwards and arrived at the Jews that way. But for me, it was his acumen with language, but also this kind of strange sort of jangly, very much informed by, you know, American country music, American outlaw country music. It was that sound, too, which was not quite as common in indie rock as it came to be later. That sort of country, twangy, this sort of weird laconic delivery. I don't know. That to me sounded really new and exciting in the mid-90s.
Yeah, like a wry, dry, I don't like to say alt-con, that's not like a real thing. I know people made a lot of money off that at a certain time period. I do not believe that it was ever a real thing, certainly not now, and definitely even not in retrospect. But as if those influences had kind of been like reduced in a pan over like a hot stove until just the kind of like, not the bitterness, but the kind of the stoicness and the acidity, sort of that's just what was left.
Yeah.
None of the kind of fanciful stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was, you know, I think of mid-90s indie rock, and I don't know what your associations are, but
I was just going to say, I don't think of mid-90s indie rock. So,
good for
you,
man.
I'm glad you're here.
I admire that about you. Truly, I mean that. Yeah, but, you know, I think of a band like Sonic Youth, which to me would be the sort of, you know, you look up indie rock in the encyclopedia and it's, you know, it's them. But there was a lot of dissonance and kind of disharmony and a sort of anger and aggression to that music, even though it was not heavy metal, but there was some kind of distance to it that I think for me as a teenager I found kind of intimidating and terrifying. You know, I tried so hard to get into Sonic Youth and I just couldn't get it to click for me because there was a bit of deliberate distance. You know, they were so cool. I was so uncool that I just couldn't sort of bridge that gap, and I didn't have that problem with David Berman, who I think was really warm. You know, and the music was warm too. It was scrappy, but it was accessible.
Nick said he had arrived at Berman after basically only listening to rap music.
Yeah.
And what connected for him was just how spoken it was.
Right.
How word first it was.
Yeah.
And I can see for someone who is fascinated with language why someone like Berman would be so appealing off the rip. Because here's a person who understands that words have this emotional resonance, but are also playthings.
Right.
They're also you know, they're Lego blocks that you can do wild things with.
And Berman was a poet. I mean, mm-hmm. you know.
Right, we haven't mentioned he had a poetry. I mean, right. He had a book. It's called Actual Air. Go cop that. I mean, I actually just looked on Amazon. It's like $200. Yeah. So maybe don't cop that. I'm sure there's a PDF.
It's too late, yeah.
Is there a PDF floating around on one of those
friend's copy.
Yeah, there's like a bootleg site somewhere, I'm sure, with a PDF.
You know, he has an MFA in poetry from the University of Massachusetts. He studied under Charles Wright at UVA. He studied with James Tate in Amherst. You know, I mean, these are, you know, heavyweight poets. He was a guy who really understood language, how language worked. And I feel like now, as we're all kind of eulogizing him and everyone's, you know, repeating their favorite Berman couplet, it sort of made me at least kind of horrifyingly aware of how terrible most lyrics are, or this sort of age-old kind of debate critics are always having amongst themselves about whether song lyrics should be read or kind of thought about as literature. And Berman was a guy who I think made everyone else look like a hack.
No, and even, you know, you look at some of the tributes that were posted online, John Darnielle, et cetera, just basically being like, and these are people who for many in the world are the A-plus people. And all the A-plus people are just like, yeah, no. It was him. He was the one.
Yeah, he feels sort of peerless in that regard. You know, I mean, they're so kind of endlessly funny. I know I just keep calling the dude funny.
But it's real.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that the reason his suicide sort of hit me so hard and I think hit many people kind of so askance is that for so long he'd been so funny about his pain and his suffering. And I think I had just assumed sort of wrongly that you know, both sides of these of the coin kind of existed in equal measure for him. And now we're realizing, all right, well, maybe one thing was a little bit bigger than the other. But it felt like such a surprise, you know? And again, you look at the lyrics and you can read them now as this sort of extended suicide note. And he'd attempted suicide before, but I was nonetheless completely shocked when I heard.
I mean, not to be all mystical about it, but art has that way of transforming this incredible pain that even if you know, I mean, you read these articles and you're like, well, this is fact. These are real things. But the mere fact of rendering it in this context allows some kind of it's not that it allows a distancing, although of course it does, but it's more that it allows some kind of transporting that you can elevate past the kind of specificity of the circumstance and experience it with some other core. What are the layers of the earth called? Right. Whatever, like the seventh layer.
Stratum?
Yeah. There's some like sixth stratum you can access it with rather than the ninth stratum.
Yeah.
Some bio, anyone out there in bio, any earth scientists out there.
Please call in.
Yeah, podcast@nytimes.com. Right. You tell me which earth core thing I f***ed up and didn't mention.
But I think also for you and I as writers, you know, we understand writing as a kind of sense-making process. When you can articulate something, you understand it, and maybe in a sense you have sort of beaten it into submission, right? Yes. Like you're holding it in your hand. You've got it, right? And I think I just
You've seen me writing. Definitely real.
I think I just thought Berman had done that. You know, he wrote so well about this stuff that I just thought, okay, well, he's written through it. He gets it. You know, he's conquered it. He owns it.
Come out the other side.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's what that process is for me. And I very wrongly and probably, you know, narcissistically presumed that he was doing that same alchemy, you know, that he was kind of making his way through it by writing.
Let's talk about some early stuff. Is there anything off the Starlight Walker record that really jumps out at you as being peak sentient Berman, you know?
I mean, for me, peak Berman, I think, really appeared on the second record.
Okay,
I think
it was
Natural Bridge, which came out in 96. Mm-hmm. That has all my favorite Silver Juice songs on it, beginning with the opening number from that album, How to Rent a Room.
Should we listen to that?
Let's listen to it.
Let's listen to How to Rent a Room, 96, Natural Bridge.
No, I don't really want to die. I only want to die in your eyes. I'm still here below your chandelier where they always used to read us our rights. I wanna wander through the night as a figure in the distance, even to my own eye. Have you ever rented a room? Have you even ever rented? Let you see the river move. But now that your evil dreams came true, there on your face a row of teeth will come to replace. I know you laughed when I left, but you really only hurt yourself. And you
see your curtains move in the wind. You can bet I'm betting against you again. 'Cause I'm a man who has a wife who has a mother.
What is it about the second album that kind of feels like it's, you know, really Berman really in his bag? What is it?
Yeah, I think this was Berman when he sort of came into his own as a lyricist. And there are certain sort of human feelings, human experiences he's capturing on that record that I had felt but never heard articulated before. So there's that kind of odd thrill of recognition of some sort of weird secret ritual that you had, and suddenly, you know, someone's singing about it and they're expressing it in this very kind of familiar and beautiful way. There's another song on Natural Bridge called Inside the Golden Days of Missing You. And he, you know, it's a breakup song and he is sort of lamenting lost love. And there's this moment in the song toward the end where he talks about the feeling starts to fade and he sort of wants to hold on to it. You know, the kind of the kind of beauty or the sort of intoxication of being sad. And I think this was a record in which he was spending a lot of time in that place where you're kind of not quite ready to let go of your own sadness. You know you're going to get over this person, but part of you doesn't want to.
Yeah, sure.
You want to just kind of luxuriate in that bad feeling for a little while and the ways in which those bad feelings can make you feel really awake to the world, awake to yourself. I had never heard someone express that before.
Yeah, sure.
It made me love him, you know, love him for that moment of solidarity and that moment of understanding.
In this era, you said you kind of arrived at Berman through Pavement. How did you experience, whether it was emotionally or musically, what he was doing in that broader context at the time? Did it feel jarring?
Yeah, to me it did.
Yeah.
To me it did. I mean, I was 16 when that record came out, right?
I mean, we could just end it here. Thank you for coming.
Right.
Because that's that's it.
Yeah, that's it. It was, you know, that was the bullseye for me, I think. And you know, 16, I don't know, you're sort of trying to figure out what being alive is, you know, and what it means to like things and what it means to dislike things and sort of who you are and what your feelings are and all that incredibly confusing stuff. And again, it was a voice, you know, it was a sort of voice from the ether saying, this is what it means. You know, this is what it means to be in love. This is what it means to lose love. It became a kind of roadmap for me. In a way, I mean, it was certainly an expression of Berman's interiority, but it felt universal. It felt really true. And I think he was so honest, you know, and he was not self-conscious, or there was no aspect of it that felt kind of overtly performative to me, which was something I heard in a lot of the other kind of guitar-based indie rock I was listening to at the time. It felt like a lot of posturing. It was a lot of, you know, I'm super cool. That was not his thing, you know, that was not his move.
It's funny because, like, yeah, we were joking before that I don't spend a lot of time thinking about indie rock of that era, and I genuinely don't. But my limited interaction with it, I often felt that posturing, and I was sort of like, it's not. I mean, don't get me wrong, I like posturing,
right.
Just of a very different kind.
Yeah.
And so, you know, arriving very late in the game to Berman and hearing that and just being like, wow, there's no varnish on this.
Yeah.
Like, at all.
Yeah, that was shocking to me as a 16-year-old.
It remains kind of shocking.
Right.
Like, how many people, who today is doing that? Phil Elverum, Mount Erie.
Right, yeah.
Maybe him, but, like, outside of that?
Yeah.
I don't know who's doing stuff like that.
Yeah, and you think of Berman's kind of predecessors, you know, the lyricists that came before him. I mean, of course, you think of Dylan.
Yeah.
And Dylan was a guy who, you know, there were 500 different layers, you know, between you and him. Between the listener and kind of Dylan's heart.
Of course.
You could glimpse it every
Dylan
once in a while.
Dylan has a heart?
Yeah. No, I don't know.
Are you
TBD,
sure?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
The x-rays have not come back. I don't know. But, you know, there was this sense of wordplay as a kind of intellectual exercise that, you know, protected a person, protected a singer. But Berman didn't use it that way.
Getting into the later Berman records, there's like a rock, more rockish record, and then there's like kind of coming out of that. Which is the musical approach that you think best suited him?
I mean, later on, the records got happier.
Yeah.
I interviewed him in 2008 when right before Lookout Mountain, Lookout Sea came out. And this was the kind of first batch of interviews he'd been doing in a while. Mm-hmm. He would have these sort of periodic disappearances.
Yeah.
But he had come back. He was married. I interviewed him at the Washington Square Hotel. I believe it was where he was staying. He was sober at the time, if I'm remembering correctly. When I was writing my piece about Berman for The New Yorker, I had mentioned something in there about him drinking seltzer. And the fact checker at the magazine was like, are you sure he drank seltzer? And I was like, oh, God. I felt, you know, it's like when you walk through, like, the airport security and the alarm goes off. And you're like, do I have a grenade in my purse? And I forgot, you know. Yeah. I was like, I don't know. I mean, maybe he wasn't drinking seltzer. I don't know. My memory of it is a bit blurry. But I do recall his kind of loquaciousness, his openness, his warmth. He would, you know, you'd ask him a question and he would just kind of espouse at length. I remember him being really obsessed in that moment with talking about how the record, that record, Lookout Mountain, Lookout Sea, was about the year 1913. And he wanted to talk about Teddy Roosevelt, you know, and these were things that would in no way have been evident to me as a listener had I not had the chance to kind of sit down and dig through them with him.
Do you think he was putting you on?
I thought about that later. When I went back and kind of reread the conversation, I was like, was this a huge joke? You know, the joke was on me and everything I thought about this guy was wrong. But there is, he does sample in a song on Lookout Mountain, Lookout Sea, he does sample Teddy Roosevelt saying, don't flinch, don't foul, hit the line hard. I guess the clues were there. I was just too big of an idiot to understand that that is a record about 1913, which Berman in that moment, I remember, pinpointed as, you know, he thought that was the year in which America as a nation had lost its faith in the idea of the hero, you know, had kind of lost its faith in heroics. So he had all these ideas that were kind of extra musical and weird about the things that he was writing. He had also just had a corneal transplant, and he had put just on the promo CD, back when critics used to get promo CDs, he had put, seriously.
Also shouts to my storage unit.
Yeah. Good for you. Yeah. I feel like I just frisbeed them all one day. I was like, I can't.
No, they're gonna have to. They're gonna have to dig me out from underneath them.
Well, in like 20 years, when I have no music library except for, you know, my vinyl records, because I threw all my promo CDs out.
Come hang
out. You can laugh at me, and then we'll hang at your storage unit.
Yeah, there's plenty of time.
But he had put a picture of his eyeball on just the promo CD. I think the actual commercial CD had a different photo on it. But it was this sense of, like, critics, you know, I'm looking at you.
Yeah.
And if you don't get that this record is about 1913, ho, ho, ho. So I don't think he was putting me on. The thought crossed my mind, but I think it was really all in there. But he seems so happy then, you know, and that is a really happy record.
You want to listen to something off that?
Yeah, why don't we listen to Strange Victory, Strange Defeat?
Let's get it.
Squirrels imported from Connecticut, just in time for fall. How much fun is a lot more fun? Not much fun at all. What's with all the handsome grandsons in these rock band magazines? And what have they done with the fat ones, the balls and the goatee? Strange victory, strange victory, strange victory, strange defeat.
So yeah, happy Berman.
Yeah, one of the things I remember him telling me about that song was that it was really significant to him, the number of times he says strange victory, which I think is in the first chorus, he says it three times before he says strange defeat. And he thought that was an appropriate ratio. Like in a person's life, you get three strange victories and then you get a strange defeat. And then the cycle starts over again.
Although interesting.
It is.
I don't know if I have found that to be true in my own life, but okay.
I'll
rock with it.
You know, on the line level, someone who was in there with a scalpel, you know, I mean, really thinking, I think, quite purposefully and with a lot of attention to details like that, you know, lyrical details like that, which is something not a lot of songwriters, you know, do or can do.
Is there a particular, whether it's album or song or era, that you find yourself returning to in the last 5-6 days as we've kind of all been processing?
I think American Water is probably the Jews' best record. It's the one that has the most Malkmus on it. So again, I feel reticent to shout it out, you know, given my defensiveness of, you know, mm-hmm. the Silver Jews getting called a pavement side project. But I think American Water is the one that, you know, if you were to just put on a record for the first time, if you'd never heard this guy before, that would be the one.
Yeah. And what specifically about it? Is it because of the sort of specifics of the pavement texture?
Well, there is a bit of that, I think. But it's a really kind of loose record. I think it's a bit freewheeling in a way that I find really beautiful. You know, there'll be guitar solos on there that seem like they just kind of trail off. It feels very immediate. It feels very instinctive. I think that to me is sort of part of what we were talking about earlier, the kind of warmth of him. You know, you just feel like you're hanging out in a room with the guy and he's noodling around on his guitar and you know, singing from his moleskin.
Right.
It just felt really close.
When you interviewed him, did you talk much about the kind of like the mechanics of songwriting or of his songwriting, whatever his process is? Did that come up at all?
Yeah, he would be so granular about it. I mean, I remember, you know, I mentioned he had just had a corneal transplant and there was this image of the eyeball on the CD. And he was saying even the title of that record, which he talked about at length, you know, the two O's in Lookout being like a set of eyes. Mm. You know, I mean, he was thinking about it on that level with a, you know, a kind of depth and determination. He also mentioned the title being a kind of spoof of Pavement's Crooked Rain, Crooked Rain.
LOL.
Yeah, you just can't get away from it. Yeah. I mean, I think that's, again, it was, you know, the sort of scalpel with which he took to language. My experience, he just loved to talk about that. You know, he would get as kind of into the nitty gritty of the words.
When you look at those other bands, you look at the Pavements of the Air, you look at those artists, and there's like a kind of, I don't know if archness is quite the right word, but that posturing that you alluded to earlier, sometimes that posturing is musical, but oftentimes it's in the kind of distance between like the character and the word in the song. And we were saying earlier, like there is maybe no distance between Berman and the character and the word.
I
mean, that's my read. Do you feel that, or do you feel something akin to that?
No, I think that's exactly right. And I, you know, he talked about that. I think it upset him that people sometimes thought he was putting them on, you know, and I think it upset him that he felt older listeners, people who were in their 30s and 40s, kind of didn't quite trust him, you know, or thought there was some sort of joke that they might be the butt of, which is probably something we all learned listening to so much Sonic Youth.
Yeah.
Much respect and love to Sonic Youth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's okay. It's Popcast. You can you can slag off Sonic Youth if you want. It's a safe space.
But he had toured, I think, for the first time in 2006 in a long time, possibly the first time really ever there had been a kind of proper Silver Jews tour. And I remember him talking about the young faces in the audience. I think he called them nice little kids. And he was sort of struck and moved by their sweetness and their earnestness and their kind of willingness to meet him in a literal place, you know, to sort of meet him with what he was saying and kind of take it at face value. I don't think he'd had that with his earlier audiences. I think he wanted it.
But of course, one of the challenges, and then we talked about the sort of this abyss-like quality, is there is something sort of as knowable as he seemed. There was obviously something that was not knowable and or wasn't, it could not be accessed through the music. And I was sort of struck by, man, I don't remember if this was the Ringer story or the Washington Post story or maybe even a third story, but, you know, the recent Purple Mountains press cycle. And in one of them, he says something to the effect of, I've never had in my career like more than 10 people come up to me and say, hey, I like what you do or your work is meaningful. And that seemed absurd, preposterous to me.
Yeah.
That seemed factually almost impossible.
Right. Yeah, agreed. I also read, I think that was in the Ring, John Lincoln's excellent Ringer piece. Yeah, I also read that and thought that can't, that I know 10 people that have sent this guy letters.
10 you know? People have sent it to me. You know, like, I'm not important. 10 people sent it to me. So certainly there's no way. Like, what do you think that was about?
Well, something must have gotten blurred. You know, I mean, it's, I don't know. I think at a certain point, maybe you kind of loosen your grip a little and you stop being able to sort of metabolize or understand your own worth, you know, and your own worth to other people. And I think tragically that is likely what happened there. But it is incredible. Yeah. I mean, how could this guy who means so much to so many people, you know, have believed that about his own work? But I think he must have, you know, and I think maybe that was a tell. I mean, we were talking about the sort of inscrutability of his suicide. And I think maybe that was, you know, a sign that he was sort of not understanding his value.
Did any of that also pop up for you with the Purple Mountains record, like with actually kind of the text of that record and the tenor of that record?
Yeah, I mean, lyrically, it's so dark.
Yeah.
And even his voice, I think, sounds, you know, it's easy to sort of go back and kind of posthumously sort of ascribe all these things to the music. But to me, I did hear a kind of heaviness in the voice. There was not necessarily the sort of lightness, I think, the playfulness that you can hear on the Juice records. He was just a bit of a heavier singer, you know, and I think I kind of chalked that up to age. I mean, he was, you know, 52 when he died. But I think certainly lyrically, there's many, many hints, you know, many suggestions of a kind of deep unrest. But again, this was something this guy had been doing at this point for, you know, for over 20 years. So I don't think there was really reason to sort of read it as any more alarming or any more immediate than anything in the past.
Right.
But it is painful, you know, even just to look at the song titles on there and think, oh, man, you know, did we... I don't know.
Right, exactly. Was it just it's hiding in plain sight?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. But there's a lot of, you know, Margaritas at the Mall. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could listen to that.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite tracks off the new Purple Mountains record.
Maybe that's a good note to go out on because that is a very special song. I would like to kind of embrace this last album in as positive a way as we can.
What is more positive than Margaritas at the Mall?
I don't know. I'm a teetotaler, so I wouldn't know. I know, I'm no fun.
No, you're healthy.
No. Well, that's not true. Jeez. Amanda, thank you for coming in. I appreciate it. Margaritas at the Mall, David Berman, Purple Mountains. For the final part of today's episode, we've sort of talked about Berman's history, the narrative of how he became who he was, and we've kind of dived into the particular qualities that made his music so special. I wanted to bring it home with something a little bit more personal. I'm fortunate enough to know Jeff Johnson. Jeff used to be the music editor at Jane. He's written for GQ and Vice and The Times and various publications, currently works in advertising, and was one of Berman's homies, basically. And I wanted to have Jeff call in and give us a little sense of Berman, the non-public Berman, the Berman that we didn't get through the records. So Jeff is calling in from, Jeff, where are you? You're in a Courtyard Marriott? Is that where we're at?
Pretty, yeah, let's call it that.
Okay, so Jeff's called in Wisconsin, Courtyard Marriott.
I'm in Chicago.
Okay, a Marriott in Chicago, which is as fine a location as one could call into Popcast from.
Exactly.
So, and also just with a quick sidebar, for many years, I can only dream of writing for Jane Magazine, and I was fortunate enough to write one record review for Jane Magazine. And that was of Yolanda Perez, who was one of the first big female Banda artists. And that review was signed by Jeff Johnson. So thank you, Jeff Johnson.
Thank you for doing it. They didn't do a lot of freelancers.
No, they didn't.
Ironically, before I was ever hired there, my first thing was a review of Actual Air.
David.
And then, I mean, it was kind of, I was on the verge of being hired, and then they were just kind of saying, start writing stuff.
Right.
And so I had to write like a 250-word story or 500-word story about that. And then I realized that every draft I was trying to put in lines that he wrote, and that would put me like well over.
Yeah, of course. You know? Right.
You know, there's no way.
There's just no way.
There's no way to do it. When you said homie of Berman's, what I've discovered over the years is that he wrote back to everybody. I had a zine ages ago before I ever worked in magazines. I just published my own zine, and that's how I got to know him. And he would just send me letters, you know, after I interviewed him. I interviewed him for Starlight Walker, and we would just exchange letters back and forth. And he would send me weird drawings and all kinds of stuff. And I thought, I still feel super great about it, super awesome about it, but I realized I wasn't that special.
Well, yes, but that was also, end. But it did take, there was, you know, the thing that you're describing is like very particularly 90s in terms of zines and epistolary yeah. friendships and things of that nature. But, you know, there's an emotional content, emotional valence to those kind of interactions. Sure. You know, it asks something of a person. You know, it's not like a, you know, responding to a DM with like the clap emoji, you know?
yeah. No, I get it. I guess what I'm trying to say is that he really thoughtfully wrote to a lot of people, yeah. and it's cool to see a lot of that pouring out now of just, you know, I think somebody's collecting these things, and there was a letter he wrote about 7 years ago to somebody who was going to rehab, and it was just, had never communicated with the person at all. It was just paragraph after paragraph of very thoughtful truths, you know,
yeah.
about what the person was going to experience. And just happens time and time again. There's somebody else that posted something that was a student who had a project that by the end of it, Berman was asking her, you know, when her next shift at the coffee shop was so that he could come and visit her. And sure enough, like he did, he made friends with people. He was very social. Yeah, he always was seeking, you know, there's that line from the Purple Mountains record about wanting to be a warm and friendly person, but not knowing how to do it. And he actually did know how to do it.
After sort of going back and forth with him, you know, in the zine era, when did you actually first meet him and sort of hang with him personally?
Well, my first experience was I met him at the actual Air release party. And that was, you know, by then it had really built up this mystique. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd written me stuff, but I'd also had been like, wow, you know, this is going to be pretty bizarre to meet him in person. I think I'd written something about this last week about how it just, American Water had just come out, Actual Air had just come out,
yep.
and this was a wild party in a loft in Tribeca. And so I just kind of dove right into it. And that was the first time I met him. But then shortly after that, I had been hired at Jane and I felt kind of like my remit at Jane Magazine, at least 20% of my remit was to put David Berman in there as much as I could.
And that was, and for those who don't remember Jane, that was a thing that one could do at Jane Magazine, perhaps more so than in any other magazine.
Sure. So I was trying to find ways to get him in there beyond reviewing records. You know, he wrote a story called Lady in Gunsmoke that was, this weird fiction story about a sci-fi writer who has writer's block and just has, you know, just filled with kind of the visuals that make his writing stand out so much.
And you told me, I think when we were texting, you said maybe like you got like a car for a weekend or something along those lines and brought him along.
There were junkets in those days.
Oh, yeah.
That was still, you know, when magazines were printed on paper, things were much different. So companies would send you places just to like drink 1 ounce of whiskey, you know, and see what you thought of it. So I got sent to Nashville on a Jack Daniel's junket. So he and Cassie and me and my wife just kind of spent the evening at this thing, just hanging out. He went along for the ride on that. It was just fun to, it was a different side of him. You know, like the drug thing never really, he kind of kept, it was a different part of his life.
Right.
It wasn't that I wasn't invited along to that, but it wasn't like something he was super psyched about displaying. I threw a weird release party for Bright Flight at Criff Dogs. I don't know if you've ever been there.
Yeah, of course.
This was before the side room was there. It was purely just like video games and hot dogs. And
tater tots. Don't sleep on the tater tots.
And tater tots. I think I was going there like probably 6 or 7 times a week at that point. And for some reason, he said yes, and Drag City said yes. So we had this thing and invited people there, and then he left. And then years later, when he was in rehab, I went and visited him, and he said, oh, sorry that I ditched out at the end of that party. I went and scored some drugs, and I had no idea. You know, at that point, right. I had no idea. You know, and it wasn't like it was a surprise, but it wasn't like I had hurt feelings, but, you know, it was just something that he felt like he needed to tell me, and a lot of different layers to the guy. But mainly, I felt smarter and deeper and cooler when I was around talking to him. You know, that was just the vibe that made me and probably like 4 zillion other people that he talked to feel feel special.
One of the things that's come up a lot in the conversation so far is the kind of an immediacy, almost doesn't even seem like a immediate enough word, but that kind of the lack of distance between, or the lack of artifice between, like, Berman the person, Berman the character, and the words and the stories and the songs. Does that resonate for you as someone who knew him personally? And, you know, when you listen to his records, are you experiencing them, and I mean this over the years, as kind of documents of actual experiences, or are you still, or are you able to still experience them as kind of art, like with a little bit of remove?
For me, they were always art, because it wasn't like, you know, like, I think what drew me to him was the artwork, you know, Starlight Walker, Natural Bridge, American Water. Those were all things that kind of came out, and I basically reacted to them as a fan before I really had a ton of conversations with him.
Right.
Yeah, those were all things that were, you can see where kind of fragments of lines may have come from. I mean, the latest record obviously is wildly different, obviously like the most direct thing that he ever did. But even in that, you can see how hard he worked on every single line, you know, even as directed as it is, you can see the labor that went into it, you know.
This is a person who cared deeply about what words belong next to what other words, you know. It's, and as a writer, and you know, you as a writer as well, I mean, these are attractive things when we hear this in a musician, you know, like this is what we gravitate to, you know. I think I certainly, when I think about music, I'm always words first.
There was no one really working as hard at words as he was, so that, I mean, that was kind of a, he was coming at it from a completely different, I mean, not at least in rock and roll. I mean, hip hop, obviously there were people going off, you know, in the 90s, totally making art. But I think in rock or alternative rock, nobody was putting the level of care into it, maybe. I don't think.
In the sort of last week or so, is there a song or something that you find yourself returning to, or that's stuck in your head?
I don't know. Not in particular. I mean, the Purple Mountains record certainly, it seems a little bit different now. Just in the last week, it's hard not to take that as a whole different kind of statement, you know, and wonder.
Do you think that the way that Berman was perceived, kind of like by his fans or by the public, was different than who he actually was in your experience?
What do you think the perception was?
That's a fair question. I think maybe certainly like after, you know, the 2003 suicide attempt and him speaking about it in the mid 2000s, I think there was a hauntedness. And I do think there was this impulse. I said earlier in the episode, I think some people had this kind of like protecting impulse with him, like sort of like,
sure,
wanted,
yeah,
to swaddle him a little bit and kind of keep him safe,
yeah,
from the storm.
I think so. I think everyone had concern. I think going back to what I was saying earlier, I think the fans of his and the people that followed his career from the start felt like they knew him. You know, I feel like I knew him probably way, way more than I actually did. And I think that impulse, I think a lot of fans were like cheering for him. You know, he's somebody that emerged from, in terms of talent, not a peer, you know, he's head and shoulders, but I think people around him felt like they were rooting for the underdog a little bit, you know, in some ways.
A few minutes ago, we were talking about this kind of craving for intimacy, his ability to connect with people. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. You know, this is a person who I think many people would have said is a form of a recluse, you know, is not interested in a public life, is not interested in being known necessarily. But you're telling me something different.
I don't think he broadcast it, but I think he was open to people. I think the thing that you brought up about him, fans feeling protective of him, I think when somebody else threw a hand up and said that they had a problem or something, I think he was a person there that was like a guide, maybe not like overtly or over the top, but he was, could share his experiences with people or help them. You know, obviously people knew that he was a teacher, he's going off to writing seminars, but you know, he seemed,
yeah,
like somebody that had wisdom to pass along.
Right.
And so, the recluse thing, I think that's what made people worry, because it's like, you know, he always found some way to articulate things. And if he wasn't articulating things anymore, like what hope did we have, you know?
It's not just that he articulated these things that seemed not able to be articulated. They were somehow beyond the reach of language.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the one thing, and I think people have said this about him before, I think people have said it about other writers, is that definitely, like, listening to those lyrics and reading those poems, like, he kind of shined a light on something that you, it made you think that you had already had the idea yourself.
Oof, yeah.
At some point, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or it was a revelation that you're like, yeah, totally, I get it. Like, it was so immediate, but, you know, it was him that came up with it, you know, it wasn't you, it, the reader, but it was there, and it was somehow he snatched it, you know,
yeah.
It was there kind of floating around. He was crafty enough to snatch it away.
Right.
There was another email that he sent when he went up to Vancouver to record with Dan Behar. He had stopped at a bookstore in Vancouver and was bent over a box of books that had been donated to this used bookstore after hours. And he was kind of looking for stuff in there, and something happened where his keys got locked inside of the bookstore. He claims that somebody thought he was a homeless guy, and the keys to the bookstore were out in front of the store, and they didn't want him to have them, so they threw him through the mail slot, but they were actually his keys. And he mentions that the last book in the box was like Far Side 4, a book of cartoons.
Right.
And I think that's like one of the closest things that you can kind of, you know, in a super positive way. His songs kind of seemed a little like the Far Side-ish world, kind of maybe moving. And so he thought for a minute that he might have been in a Far Side cartoon at the time, trying to break into a store to get his own keys back. Why people around there helped him.
Well, I don't think I can pick a better conclusion to the episode than that story. Jeff, thanks for calling in from the Marriott corporate system today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on. It's a bummer to be on for this reason. But
is there a particular Berman song you'd like us to go out with today?
I think We Are Real.
Let's go out. We Are Real.
Repair is the dream of the broken thing. Like a message broadcast on an overpass.
That's our show this week. I want to thank all my guests, Nick Weidenfeld, Amanda Petrusich, and Jeff Johnson. Well, first of all, listen to Silver Jews. Then listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us any of your Berman memories or particular songs or lyrics that are meaningful to you at podcast@nytimes.com. And subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content, et cetera, et cetera. You know where all that stuff is. Our producers this week are Dan Powell in the room and Pedro Rosado on a beach somewhere. We'll be back next week.
Won't soul music change now that our souls have turned strange once a day?
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that enables your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.